"If only he had not been killed," they all said, "we would have made him a king. Bard, the dragon shooter of the line of Geryon, alas that he is lost." And in the very midst of their talk, a tall figure stepped from the shadows. He was drenched with water. His black hair hung wet over his face and shoulders, and a fierce light was in his eyes.
"Bard is not lost," he cried. "He dived from Esgaroth when the enemy was slain. I am Bard of the line of Geryon. I am the slayer of the dragon."
"King Bard! King Bard!" they shouted, but the master ground his chattering teeth. "Geryon was lord of Dale, not king of Esgaroth," he said. "In the lake town, we've always elected masters from among the old and wise, and have not endured the rule of mere fighting men. Let King Bard go back to his own kingdom. Dale is now freed by his valor, and nothing hinders his return. And any that wish can go with him, if they prefer the cold shores under the shadow of the mountain to the green shores of the lake. The wise will stay here and hope to rebuild our town, and enjoy again in time its peace and riches."
"We will have King Bard," the people near at hand shouted in reply. "We've had enough of the old men and the money counters." And people further off took up the cry, "Up the Bourbon, and down with Moneybags," till the clamour echoed along the shore.
"I am the last man to undervalue Bard the Bowman," said the master warily, for Bard now stood close beside him. "He has tonight earned an eminent place in the roll of the benefactors of our town, and is worthy of many imperishable songs. But why, oh, people!" And here the master rose to his feet and spoke very loud and clear. "Why do I get all your blame? For what fault am I to be deposed? Who aroused the dragon from his slumber, I might ask? Who obtained of us rich gifts and ample help, and led us to believe that old songs could come true? Who played on our soft hearts and our pleasant fancies? What sort of gold have they sent down the river to reward us? Dragon, fire, and ruin? From whom should we claim the recompense of our damage, and aid for our widows and orphans?" As you see, the master had not got his position for nothing. The result of his words was that for the moment the people quite forgot their idea of a new king, and turned their angry thoughts towards Thorin and his company. Wild and bitter words were shouted from many sides, and some of those who had before sung the old songs loudest were now heard as loudly crying that the dwarves had stirred the dragon up against them deliberately.
"Fools," said Bard, "why waste words and wrath on those unhappy creatures? Doubtless they perished first in fire before Smaug came to us."
Then, even as he was speaking, the thought came into his heart of the fabled treasure of the mountain, lying without guard or owner, and he fell suddenly silent. He thought of the master's words, and of Dale rebuilt, and filled with golden bells, if he could but find the men. At length he spoke again.
"This is no time for angry words, master, or for considering weighty plans of change. There's work to do. I serve you still, though after a while I may think again of your words and go north with any that will follow me."
Then he strode off to help in the ordering of the camps, and in the care of the sick and the wounded. But the master scowled at his back as he went, and remained sitting on the ground. He thought much, but said little, unless it was to call loudly for men to bring him fire and food. Now everywhere Bard went, he found talk running like fire among the people concerning the vast treasure that was now unguarded. Men spoke of the recompense for all their harm that they would soon get from it, and wealth over and to spare with which to buy rich things from the south, and it cheered them greatly in their plight. That was as well, for the night was bitter and miserable.
shelters could be contrived for few. The master had one, and there was little food. Even the master went short. Many took ill of wet and cold and sorrow that night, and afterwards died, who had escaped uninjured from the ruin of the town. And in the days that followed, there was much sickness and great hunger. Meanwhile Bard took the lead, and ordered things as he wished, though always in the master's name, and he had a hard task to govern the people and direct the preparations for their protection and housing. Probably most of them would have perished in the winter, that now hurried after autumn, if help had not been to hand. But help came swiftly, for Bard at once had speedy messengers sent up river to the forest to ask the aid of the king of the elves of the wood, and these messengers had found a host already on the move, although it was then only the third day after the fall of Smaug. The elven king had received news from his own messengers and from the birds that loved his folk, and already knew much of what had happened. Very great indeed was the commotion among all things with wings that dwelt on the borders of the desolation of the dragon. The air was filled with circling flocks, and their swift flying messengers flew here and there across the sky. Above the borders of the forest there was whispering, crying, and piping. Far over Mirkwood tidings spread. Smaug is dead! Leaves rustled and startled ears were lifted. Even before the elven king rode forth, the news had passed west, right to the pine woods of the Misty Mountains. Bjorn had heard it in his wooden house, and the goblins were at council in their caves.
"That will be the last we shall hear of Thorin Oakenshield, I fear," said the king. "He would have done better to have remained my guest. It is an ill wind, all the same," he added, "that blows no one any good." For he, too, had not forgotten the legend of the wealth of Thror. So it was that Bard's messengers found him now marching with many spearmen and bowmen, and crows were gathered thick above him, for they thought that war was awakening again, such as had not been in those parts for a long age. But the king, when he received the prayers of Bard, had pity, for he was the lord of a good and kindly people. So turning his march, which had at first been direct toward the mountain, he hastened now down the river to the long lake. He had not boats or rafts enough for his host, and they were forced to go the slower way by foot. But great store of goods he sent ahead by water. Still, elves are light-footed, and though they were not in these days much used to the marches and the treacherous lands between the forest and the lake, their going was swift. Only 5 days after the death of the dragon, they came upon the shores and looked on the ruins of the town. Their welcome was good, as may be expected, and the men and their master were ready to make any bargain for the future in return for the elven king's aid. Their plans were soon made. With the women and the children, the old and the unfit, the master remained behind, and with him were some men of crafts and many skilled elves, and they busied themselves felling trees and collecting the timber sent down from the forest. Then they set about raising many huts by the shore against the oncoming winter. And also, under the master's direction, they began the planning of a new town, designed more fair and large even than before, but not in the same place. They had moved northward higher up the shore, for ever after they had a dread of the water where the dragon lay. He would never again return to his golden bed, but was stretched cold as stone, twisted upon the floor of the shallows. There, for ages, his huge bones could be seen in calm weather amid the ruined piles of the old town. But few dared to cross the cursed spot, and none dared to dive into the shivering water, or recover the precious stones that fell from his rotting carcass. But all the men of arms, who were still able, and the most of the elven king's array, got ready to march north to the mountain. It was thus that in 11 days from the ruin of the town, the head of their host passed the rock gates at the end of the lake,
and came into the desolate lands. Chapter 15. The Gathering of the Clouds. Now we will return to Bilbo and the dwarves. All night one of them had watched, but when morning came, they had not heard or seen any sign of danger. But ever more thickly the birds were gathering. Their companies came flying from the south, and the crows that still lived about the mountain were wheeling and crying unceasingly above.
"Something strange is happening," said Thorin. "The time has gone for the autumn wanderings, and these are birds that dwell always in the land. There are starlings and flocks of finches, and far off there are many carrion birds, as if a battle were afoot."
Suddenly Bilbo pointed.
"There is that old thrush again," he cried.
"He seems to have escaped when Smaug smashed the mountainside, but I don't suppose the snails have."
Sure enough, the old thrush was there, and as Bilbo pointed, he flew towards them and perched on a stone nearby. Then he fluttered his wings and sang. Then he cocked his head on one side as if to listen, and again he sang, and again he listened.
"I believe he's trying to tell us something," said Balin. "But I can't follow the speech of such birds. It's very quick and difficult. Can you make it out, Baggins?"
"Not very well," said Bilbo. As a matter of fact, he could make nothing of it at all. "But the old fellow seems very excited."
"I only wish he was a raven," said Balin.
"I thought you didn't like them. You seemed very shy of them when we came this way before."
"Those were crows, and nasty, suspicious-looking creatures at that, and rude as well. You must have heard the ugly names they were calling after us. But the ravens are different. There used to be great friendship between them and the people of Thror, and they often brought us secret news, and were rewarded with such bright things as they coveted to hide in their dwellings. They live many a year, and their memories are long, and they hand on their wisdom to their children. I knew many among the ravens of the rocks when I was a dwarf lad. This very height was once named Ravenhill, because there was a wise and famous pair, old Kark and his wife, that lived here above the guard chamber. But I don't suppose that any of that ancient breed linger here now."
No sooner had he finished speaking than the old thrush gave a loud call and immediately flew away.
"We may not understand him, but that old bird understands us, I'm sure," said Balin. "Keep watch now and see what happens."
Before long there was a fluttering of wings, and back came the thrush. And with him came a most decrepit old bird. He was getting blind, he could hardly fly, and the top of his head was bald. He was an aged raven of great size. He alighted stiffly on the ground before them, slowly flapped his wings, and bobbed towards Thorin.
"Oh, Thorin, son of Thrain, and Balin, son of Fundin," he croaked,
and Bilbo could understand what he said, for he used ordinary language and not bird speech.
"I am Roek, son of Kark. Kark is dead, but he was well known to you once. It is 100 years and 53 since I came out of the egg, but I do not forget what my father told me. Now I am the chief of the great ravens of the mountain. We are few, but we remember still the king that was of old. Most of my people are abroad, for there are great tidings in the south. Some are tidings of joy to you, and some you will not think so good. Behold, The birds are gathering back again to the mountain and to dale from south and east and west, for word has gone out that Smaug is dead.
Dead? Dead? Shouted the dwarves. Dead? Then we have been in needless fear, and the treasure is ours!
They all sprang up and began to caper about for joy.
Yes, dead, said Roach. The thrush, may his feathers never fall, saw him die, and we may trust his words. He saw him fall in battle with the men of Esgaroth the third night back from now at the rising of the moon.
It was some time before Thorin could bring the dwarves to be silent and listen to the raven's news. At length, when he had told all the tale of the battle, he went on.
So much for joy, Thorin Oakenshield. You may go back to your halls in safety. All the treasure is yours, for the moment. But many are gathering hither beside the birds. The news of the death of the guardian has already gone far and wide, and the legend of the wealth of Thrá has not lost in the telling during many years. Many are eager for a share of the spoil. Already a host of the elves is on the way, and carrion birds are with them, hoping for battle and slaughter. By the lake, men murmur that their sorrows are due to the dwarves, for they are homeless, and many have died, and Smaug has destroyed their town. They, too, think to find amends from your treasure, whether you are alive or dead. Your own wisdom must decide your course, but 13 is small remnant of the great folk of Durin that once dwelt here, and now are scattered far. If you will listen to my counsel, you will not trust the master of the lakemen, but rather him that shot the dragon with his bow. Bard is he, of the race of Tail, of the line of Gideon. He is a grim man, but true. We would see peace once more among dwarves and men and elves after the long desolation, but it may cost you dear in gold. I have spoken.
Then Thorin burst forth in anger.
Our thanks, Roach Kark's son. You and your people shall not be forgotten. But none of our gold shall thieves take or the violent carry off while we are alive. If you would earn our thanks still more, bring us news of any that draw near. Also I would beg of you, if any of you are still young and strong of wing, that you would send messengers to our kin in the mountains of the north, both west from here and east, and tell them of our plight. But go specially to my cousin Dain in the Iron Hills, for he has many people well armed, and dwells nearest to this place. Bid him hasten.
I will not say if this counsel be good or bad, croaked Roach. But I will do what can be done.
Then off he slowly flew.
Back now to the mountain, cried Thorin. We have little time to lose.
And little food to use, cried Bilbo, always practical on such points. In any case, he felt that the adventure was, properly speaking, over with the death of the dragon, in which he was much mistaken. And he would have given most of his share of the profits for the peaceful winding up of these affairs.
Back to the mountain, cried the dwarves, as if they had not heard him.
So back he had to go with them. As you've heard some of the events already, you will see that the dwarves still had some days before them. They explored the caverns once more, and found, as they expected, that only the front gate remained open. All the other gates, except, of course, the small secret door, had long ago been broken and blocked by Smaug, and no sign of them remained. So now they began to labor hard in fortifying the main entrance,
and in remaking the road that led from it. Tools were to be found in plenty that the miners and quarriers and builders of old had used, and at such work the dwarves were still very skilled. As they worked, the ravens brought them constant tidings. In this way, they learned that the elven king had turned aside to the lake, and they still had a breathing space. Better still, they heard that three of their ponies had escaped and were wandering wild, far down the banks of the running river, not far from where the rest of their stores had been left. So while the others went on with their work, Feely and Keely were sent, guided by a raven, to find the ponies and bring back all they could. They were 4 days gone, and by that time they knew that the joined armies of the lake men and the elves were hurrying towards the mountain. But now their hopes were higher, for they had food for some weeks with care, chiefly cram, of course, and they were very tired of it. But cram is much better than nothing, and already the gate was blocked with a wall of squared stones laid dry, but very thick and high across the opening. There were holes in the wall through which they could see or shoot, but no entrance.